33. Isaiah chapter 33. We have been studying a series of woes in these chapters in the last few weeks. We will be dealing with another this morning that actually pertains again to the empire of Assyria. There will be a woe to the spoiler, the one that has dealt so treacherously with Jerusalem, and we'll see a principle from the New Testament in action in the Old Testament. Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. So we'll read this chapter, then we'll come back. It's 24 verses, and this particular chapter, we'll come back and deal with it, try to put it into a setting so that we can appreciate it and understand that which is being said. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. The noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar, as the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. The earth mourneth and languisheth. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Now will I rise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself. Ye shall conceive chaff. Ye shall bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you. And the people shall be as the burning of lime, and or as thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire. Hear ye that are far off what I have done, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppression, that shaketh his hands from holding of bribes, that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood, and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil. He shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be the munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given him. His water shall be sure. Thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. Thine heart shall meditate terror. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Where is he that counteth the towers? Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech than thou canst perceive, of a stammering tongue that thou canst not understand. Look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. But there the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall go no galley with oars, neither shall galleon or gallop a ship pass thereby. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us. Thy tacklings are loose, they could not well strengthen their mast, they could not spread the sail. Then is the prey of a great spoil divided, the lame take the prey. And the inhabitant shall not say, I am sick. The people that dwell therein shall be forgiven their iniquity. Now I think that as we read this, that you begin to look in your mind and say, what in the world is he talking about? Well, let me put it in a historical setting so that we can appreciate it. Then it begins to unfold to us a little bit. Certainly, we are using what could be deemed a poetic or descriptive language here. Certainly, there is a method that Isaiah is using to draw some pictures in our minds so that we can appreciate the Lord and all of his beauty and his greatness. But the setting, of course, again, is in the days of Hezekiah. Remember that Israel and Jerusalem and the southern kingdom in particular had been somewhat subjugated by Assyria or had been subservient to them. They had paid them tribute as the custom of the day was. The Assyrians had a unique way of prospering their kingdom instead of having a national gross product. They just simply plundered and pillaged and brought folks into subjection and put a tax upon them, and consequently year by year they'd pay. Well, in our setting, Hezekiah had sent out some ambassadors to meet the Assyrian army that had already come through Lebanon and other places and had subdued many kingdoms or nations, and was on his way and had come through Israel and now was on his way to Jerusalem. And Hezekiah had taken gold from the temple and from his treasures and had sent these ambassadors out, and there was supposedly an agreement, but Sennacherib would not keep that agreement. He just simply came forward on toward Jerusalem, and consequently, as he came, as it is described for us here, they cried without, or they came even before the gates of the city. If you were to look back into the book of 2 Kings, you'd find the story as it unfolds there that they came, and the men that went out to talk with these representatives of the Assyrian Empire said to them, speak to us in the Syrian tongue, don't speak to us in Hebrew, so that the folks on the wall won't be discouraged. And they said, we'll speak to all of them. And so they broadcast it in Hebrew so that all on the walls would hear them and ultimately disheartened. But Hezekiah and some of the leaders were somewhat moved by this, and they went before the Lord, and God gave them the promise that this army would be destroyed, that it would never come into the gates of Jerusalem, even though they were before it. Now, Sennacherib felt sure that he could do that. He even denounced God and said, your God's not any greater than any of these other gods, and he'll not deliver you out of our hand. What makes you think so? In other words, it was blasphemy, what it was. And consequently, the Lord said, because he's said this, I'll prove myself. And you remember the story how 185,000 of them just died in a night under the hand of God, and Sennacherib fled back home, and his own sons took his life, and another of his sons would take his place on the throne of Assyria. So we see now this is the setting that is before us as this prophet Isaiah now pronounces this woe. And when he speaks to the spoiler, thee that spoil us, he's talking about Assyria. And it is a woe that is pronounced upon them in verse 1. And so in verses 1 through 6, really we have this woe as it is presented. And there are some different aspects of it. So we'll look at that first of all in the first 6 verses. Assyria is described for us in this first verse. He said, woe to thee that spoil us, and thou wast not spoiled. Now, Hezekiah had been basically honest in his attempt to appease this Assyrian king and his army so that they would not attack Jerusalem. In other words, they did not go out and try to spoil them. They had not lifted up their hand in battle to defend themselves. They had gone down into Egypt and tried to make an alliance there that would help. But we'll notice that that highway was cut off and the wayfarers did not make it out of Egypt to help them. But nonetheless, it is described for us here as the spoilers that were not spoiled. And then he said, and dealest treacherously, and thou, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. In other words, they, when Hezekiah sent the offering, the gold, to Sennacherib, it was assumed that this was a straightforward deal. It was not something where he was trying to deceive this king or to deal treacherously with him. But on the other hand, the Assyrians did deal treacherously. They took the offering, but they came on in an attack anyway. And so this nation is described as a treacherous nation that was not dealt treacherously with. And when thou shalt cease to spoil, he said, thou shalt be spoiled. Now, again, we notice here the turn of events is God said, what you sow, you shall reap. And in this particular case, the Assyrians are going to reap what they have sown. In other words, they have spoiled without being spoiled, as they have dealt treacherously and having not been dealt treacherously with or against. God says, I'm going to bring this to task, and I'm going to make you to account for that which you have done. Now, if we were to make this applicable today and bring it into everyday life, there is no such thing as a free lunch and a free ride. God is going to bring every transgression into judgment. You can rest assured of that, that God will deal with men as they have been dealt with. And there'll not be a person that'll be able to stand before God in that day and say that you dealt with me unfairly. God deals in retribution as to men have dealt in their lives. And here collectively this Assyrian army under Sennacherib has now dealt very treacherously with Jerusalem, with Hezekiah the king. And the Lord is saying, you weren't spoiled, but you will be spoiled. And certainly that was true. When the army of Sennacherib was destroyed in a night, the plague came through. Just literally took these 185,000 lives. And consequently, he was left with hardly any army at all, and he fled. Well, there was a massive wealth, at least, that was left behind. And they were spoiled. And so God is saying that you will reap as you have sown. And that is very true. And said, and when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. In other words, they will take that spoil. And so the Lord is saying to them that you come with the thought in mind that I'm not powerful, that I'm just a God like all the gods of the nations that you have come through, but God will prove himself in behalf of his children. Now, this is not only true in Hezekiah's day, but it will be true again in a greater day whenever the fellow that we know as the beast that rises up out of the sea, the one that will come up out of the nations, will take his place and ultimately, finally say to Israel, even though we have a covenant for your safety, we're going to not honor that covenant. And I'm going to sit upon that throne and you'll have to acknowledge me as God. God will stand in behalf of the people of Israel and the city of Jerusalem again in that particular day. And he will spoil even the spoiler in that day as well. Read of them and the finality of it, that the beast is taken along with the false prophet, and they're cast into the bottomless pit. And so God will deal and with Jerusalem. But in verse 2 then, after the description of the Assyrians, we have then the prayer of Isaiah as he prays and pleads to the Lord for the city of Jerusalem, for his people. He said, O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. Now, if we would just analyze this prayer for a moment, he's asking for God's grace. Be gracious unto us. In other words, he understands that they are not really worthy of what he's asking for, just as we understand today as New Testament saints that we're not really worthy of what we ask God for each day. Even though we ask him for his daily provision of food, and God is gracious to give it to us as he promised, the question of worthiness is, oh, not enter into it because we're not worthy. I mean, it's grace and graciousness. And in this particular case, as he prays, he's not putting on the basis of their worth or their worthiness because they could not stand any better than we can over in the New Testament. Remember, the discussion was in the church in Jerusalem with regard to the message that had been preached to the Gentiles. There were certain ones that said they need to be brought under the old covenant, under the law of Moses. And Simon Peter stood up and said, why put a greater burden on them than we've had? We can't even bear that burden ourselves. We've proven that. And so that's true. So we're dealing now, as the Lord has appealed to, Isaiah appeals on the basis of graciousness or God's grace. And then he said, we've waited for thee. In other words, he's simply stating that we're not trusting anyone else but you. Now, God does not want to divide his honor, his praise, nor his worship with anyone, and he will not. Now, if we were to look at jealousy in its proper state, if there was a perfect demonstration of jealousy, it's the Lord's jealousy. Now, human jealousy is a different thing, and it's destructive. It is described in a secular sense as a green-eyed monster, and in the Bible it's described as worse than death. So it's a horrible thing. But on God's part, from God's vantage point, it's a different story. When God is jealous over a people, he will not share his glory with another. And men today are not going to be able to divide their attention and cover all their bases and worship God and somebody else, hoping that they just hit the right number sometime. But Isaiah is saying, we waited for you. Or we're waiting upon you. Their faith is in the Lord and in no one else. And so this is the basis of his prayer now, that we're looking to you and your bountiful hand. We are not looking to ourselves nor anything else. We're honestly trusting your grace. And then he asked, as they waited for the Lord, be thou their arm every morning. In other words, be the very strength and security of this people every day. They were living in perilous times, as they are described for us in the Bible. They lived in a day whenever it looked overwhelming. If we were to keep in mind this Assyrian army under Sennacherib that's outside the city of Jerusalem, it looked very hopeless for this people. So they needed an arm. They needed strength. And you and I, the truth of the matter is, every day that we face is a treacherous day, except God's arm be strong in our behalf. But when he stands strong in our behalf, then it makes it a good day. It makes it a different day for us. There's not a one of us that dare get up and face this life without the Lord. We need him every moment, every day of our lives, and we need his arm in our behalf. And so Isaiah is saying, be their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. In other words, as the things come that would normally overwhelm, just be our salvation. This is speaking of basically a physical salvation in this case, because, again, the army is before them. There's an imminent danger of invasion, and he's asking that they be saved from that invasion. But as we think about it in the broader sense, is it not true that every one of us needs saving from something every day in our lives? In the prayer, the Lord taught his disciples, or was teaching his disciples, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. In other words, that's salvation. That's our salvation every day, to be led right and to be kept from that which would befall us and would turn us aside from following the Lord. So we see in this prayer then the cry of this particular prophet as he asked the Lord to deal with this nation in mercy. And then in verses 3 and 4 we see that the Lord will arise in answer to this request and will stand in their defense. So that the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. Now, when the Lord literally lifted up himself or stood for the nation of Israel, well, certainly at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. I would think that those that survived that night when God struck the Assyrian army would have enough sense to flee. I believe if I was in this large army of the Assyrians and 185,000 died around me in one night, I believe I'd just get up and run just as fast as I could, and certainly would flee as it is described for us here. So at the very noise of the tumult, the people fled. Lifting up with thyself, the nations were scattered. God is standing in behalf of the children of Israel and the city of Jerusalem. Your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. At the running to and fro the locust shall he run upon them. In other words, you know, Israel is presented, Jerusalem is presented now as the act of the caterpillar, the gathering, and the locust that run to and fro. I've read of the locust plagues. We had, I guess, what you would call, in a sense, the locust up in our country. We call them grasshoppers. They make good perch bait and other things. But they can be very destructive as they run to and fro through a field, and or they hit an orchard, they can begin to strip the leaves from the trees. And whenever you get the real plague of locusts, like the Bible describes, most of them come off of North Africa and come up into the Holy Land. They would just literally run to and fro. And when they pass through a field, the trees would be bare, the ground would be bare, the crops would be taken. And here the description is that this is the scene. This Assyrian camp now will be spoiled. It'll be taken by the very fact that the Lord has arisen in behalf of those that are in the city of Jerusalem. And so we have the Lord arising in these verses. And then at the presence of the Lord, Jerusalem is filled with justice and righteousness in verse 5. He said, the Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment or justice and righteousness. Sin, iniquity, does not abide in the presence of the Lord. There are things that will occur when the Lord arises and he stands in a particular place. Honestly, where the Lord stands, that place becomes hallowed ground. I might remind you of the scene of the tabernacle. Whenever it was set up, there were certain prohibitions where men could not go, just the natural man, a common man could not go. The Israelite at large could bring his offering to the gate, but it was the Levites and the priestly family that could take the offering, and they could go in behind into the holy place, and then into the holiest of all. Only the high priest could go. Because of the presence of the Lord, there are prohibitions. Remember when Moses came to the burning bush, God said, take off your shoes from off your feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. The ground was not any different than the ground here, except through the presence of the Lord. And so the city of Jerusalem is described for us now as a place of justice and righteousness because of the presence of the Lord. And that day that we look for in the future, when he does take his rightful place on the throne, I'll guarantee you Jerusalem is going to be more righteous and more just than it's ever been in all the history of this world because of the presence of the Lord. And whenever the Lord is in a place, that's why I think there ought to be the measure of respect for the house of God today. We're in the presence of the Lord. I think that things need to be conducted in a proper fashion in that sense because of the presence of the Lord. That makes the difference. Now, this building would be no different than any other building except the Lord abides in this place. And that makes the difference. So the Lord is now standing in behalf of the city of Jerusalem. And at the presence of the Lord, there's justice and there's righteousness that prevails. And then salvation is the strength of Jerusalem in verse 6. And he said, wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. And strength of salvation, the fear of the Lord is his treasure. In other words, that's our treasure, that's our riches today, to know the Lord, the knowledge of the Lord, and then to have salvation is the strength of Jerusalem. And so, in a spiritual sense, so is salvation the strength of our lives today. That's how we stand today. Because we have been saved by the grace of God, we have been indwelt by the Spirit of God, and therefore that is our strength of our lives. Now, we go on in verses 7 through 9 to a second major point. All this is under number 1 in verses 1 through 6. Woe to the spoiler. Now, Syria is dealing with Jerusalem in these verses 7 through 9. It said, behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. In other words, these men, representative of the Assyrian Empire, came and they stood without. And they cried out. They did everything they could to discourage the men on the wall of the city of Jerusalem. And that was their cry. But Jerusalem's ambassadors have also been unsuccessful. They thought they had an agreement, but when it comes down to it, the ambassador to peace shall weep bitterly. In other words, they are disappointed now that that army's out there because they have now nowhere else to turn, except to the Lord, of course. If you had given all of your money to this fellow that came up with a gun and he said, I'll leave you alone if you give me all your money. He gave him all your money. And then he said, I'm still going to kill you. What are you going to do? In other words, you have no options. You're at their mercy, and especially at the mercy of the Lord. And, of course, Isaiah has cried out. But this is the dealing now. Assyria is dealing with the city of Jerusalem. And then the ways are closed, and there are no travelers in verse 8. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. In other words, there's not any approach of help. Assyria has taken and closed the roads, the highways. The travelers now can't come in. And if there was any help in Egypt, it's certainly not going to come now. And so we see a scene that is before us, that Assyria has broken the covenant, her agreement with Jerusalem. And They're in desperate circumstance in verse 9. The earth mourneth and languishes. Lebanon is ashamed, hewed down. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. And so we see, as Assyria deals with the city of Jerusalem, that there are desperate circumstances. But now God will arise in verses 10 through 16. In verse 10, he will be exalted. He says, "Now will I arise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself." Again, the Lord is presenting himself. And he points out then that Assyria will be destroyed. Now, he said, "Ye shall conceive chaff. Ye shall bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you." Now, you rest assured that God is a God of justice and a God of judgment. And he's able to judge. And his word is exact. And he does not equivocate. Therefore, these proud folks that will stand and defy God and challenge him to do to them various things, I would have shuddered to stand as some of them did in other days as atheists, and they'd take their watch. I think it was Ingersoll do this. He'd say, "I'm going to give God 5 minutes to kill me," and then he'd blaspheme God for the 5 minutes. The truth of the matter is, sometimes God does take their lives. Some say, "Well, the Lord left him alone in mercy." Well, he did if he was left alone. But in the days of Billy Sunday, there was a fellow in a bar one time, and he was blaspheming God and challenging God, and God struck him, and he fell to the floor dead. Another, in the same book as it relates his life, talked about how that one walked out in the yard and was blaspheming God, and he was strangled by a gnat. God sometimes does take life. God is able to judge. I want you to see that picture, and this is what is being said here. When the Lord arises, Assyria will be destroyed. There will be great fear and also great joy. And verse 13, verse 12 deals again with the judgment of God. The people shall be as the burnings of lime, as thorns cut up, shall they be burned in the fire. In other words, it's going to be a destruction of that people. And the Babylonians did destroy completely the Assyrians, by the way, in that sense. They were never an empire again. Now I said, "Hear ye that are far off, and what I have done, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might." And so this goes far and near, and into, of course, to Jerusalem. It's good joy, news. It's joy to the folks in Jerusalem. And it should be a warning to those far and wide. And it certainly should sober folks today. Let me just say that certainly, again, God is able to judge, and consequently when he judges, it does bring fear to his name. It does bring joy to those who have been shown mercy. Now, sinners in Jerusalem are also addressed in this. It's not all just on this inside, but there are hypocrites that stand in the on the other side that are certainly going to, that God's going to deal with. And this particular case, he said, the sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with a devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burning? Now, as we see this, this is not a description of hell, but this is a description of God. God himself said, "I'm a consuming fire." There's one thing that bothers me much today is the familiarity with God. And with the ease that folks speak of God and how that they come into his presence. I believe that God is approachable because the way into the holy stall was open. When our Lord died on the cross, the veil that was in the then physical temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, indicating that the way into the holiest of all was open. But always keep in mind, it was the holiest of all and is the holiest of all. God is approachable, but we don't approach him in a casual manner. I think Cain wanted to approach God, but he wanted to approach him in a casual manner, on his own terms. Understand today that the presence of God, again, will expose the hypocrite. And those in Jerusalem now, on the other side, we see what God's going to do to the Assyrian. Now, what happens here is that because of the presence of the Lord, the hypocrites in Jerusalem, now they begin to get disturbed because of this one that is described for us in such a way as a devouring fire and these everlasting burnings. I mean, God is consuming fire. Who now can abide in his presence? Remember in the New Testament, there was a time when God judged a couple. They had lied to God. Ananias and Sapphira. And the Bible said there was great fear came upon all. And he said those that were outside or those of the other persuasion dare not join themselves to them. Now the church was very pure in those days because of the fear of the Lord in the presence of the Lord. Now, tragically today, as it's been said before, it's trite but still true, the world has become so churchy and the church becomes so worldly that it's difficult to discern the difference. But in that day, the folks understood, say, that's a place of righteousness, and God expects righteousness in that church, and we'll not go over there with any pretenses. Well, here in Jerusalem, they're somewhat troubled now. The hypocrites are. They say, who's going to abide this burning? Who's going to abide the presence of the Lord? Well, the answer is given for us. And I think that we can certainly see that there are certain ones who can abide. And that's in verses 15 and 16. He said, he that walketh righteously. In other words, there's one who has turned his steps. This is honest repentance. In the Bible, the indication of real repentance in the Bible is a man, he's turned from sin to righteousness. He's turned from self to the Lord and on down the line. In the book of 1 Thessalonians, we're told that he turned to God from idols to serve the living and the true God. In other words, that's real repentance as you find it in the Bible. So here's one who has turned from a waywardness to walk righteously and will speak uprightly. He that despiseth the gain of oppression, in other words, is not going to be oppressive and greedy, that shaketh his hands from holding of bribes. When a bribe is put in your hand, he simply throws it away. As this is describing one that certainly is indicative of the fact that he knows the Lord. He said that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil. He shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be the munition of rocks. Bread shall be given him. His water shall be sure. And in this poetic language, God is describing for us that has certainly turned from his own self-righteousness to the hand of God and the righteousness of God. That's the one that can abide in the presence of the Lord. And so this is described for us now in these verses as the Lord arises. But when the Lord abides in Jerusalem, now in verses 17 on through 24. Now we're going to look beyond the day of Hezekiah and Sennacherib. We're going to look beyond into another day. I believe that is a far greater day. He said, thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. I believe that in a sense they saw by faith the Lord's beauty that day. But in that day, in that great day of the coming of the Lord to take his rightful place as king in the city of Jerusalem, they'll behold his beauty physically with the eyes that are up in their head and upon their face. They'll be able to look upon him and all of his glorious beauty. He said, thine heart shall meditate terror there. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Where is he that counteth the towers? Thou shalt not see a fierce people. And he comes back in reference to that army that is before them. You'll not see this fierce people, a people of deeper speech than thou canst perceive, of a stammering tongue that thou canst not understand. In other words, you're not going to see this army before you. And in that day, that army that surrounds Jerusalem and intends to utterly destroy it, in that future day, when the Lord arises, even with healing in his wings, and comes in splendid glory, that army will not be there, as the Assyrian army was not before Jerusalem in Isaiah's day. And he said, look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. Again, this has not occurred because we have seen Jerusalem time and again taken down. Not only did the Babylonians come and take Jerusalem down later, the Romans came and took Jerusalem down at another date. And there's been trouble. And there's even now discussion about giving up part of Jerusalem again. Apparently there's a liberal leader in Israel today that's willing to compromise. And I noticed just, I think it's yesterday in the paper, that he talked about giving up a portion of Jerusalem. Well, in other words, we see it oftentimes taken down. And in this particular case, Jerusalem is described as a city and actually as a tabernacle or a tent. The picture goes back to the Old Testament tabernacle. As the stakes were driven and the cords were tied, he said it'll be a tabernacle that'll never be taken down. It'll never be moved. Oh, what a glorious day lies in the future whenever we see the Lord abiding in Jerusalem. We see the king in his beauty. And it'll be such as has never been taken down. Well, I need to go on because time's gone, and we'll allow you some time to ask questions. Let's just look at these final verses. But there the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams. Now this is picture pictorial language now. Broad rivers and streams. In other words, the blessing of a land is to have water. And he said, wherein shall go no galley with oars, neither shall galleon ship pass through. There'll be no battleships come through. There'll be no trials that will come. No threat will ever come through the Lord, as the Lord is the broad river and the streams for the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. He said, for the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. He will save us. There'll be no threats because the Lord is king. Their tacklings are loosed. They could not well strengthen their mast. They could not spread the sail. Then is the prey of a great spoil divided. The lame take the prey. Well, that which seemingly was impossible became possible as God dealt with the Assyrian army and allowed Jerusalem to spoil them. And so will it be in another day. You see, the Lord stands strong in their defense. They cannot help themselves, but God helps them. The Lord saves. And then finally, and the inhabitants shall not say, I am sick. The peoples that dwell therein shall be forgiven their iniquity. And we understand that God is speaking to a people in that day as well, but in another day, there will be the full reality of the new covenant that God will make with the nation of Israel. And God will save that people in that day. Well, I think it's been an interesting chapter. It has been to me. I hope it's encouraged you.